Well, welcome to the latest installment of Amherst Reads, a series of recorded interviews that celebrates the literary and scholarly accomplishments of Amherst graduates and faculty members. My name is Paul Rockwell, and I've been teaching for 20 years now at the Amherst College Department of French. We feel most fortunate today to have with us a novelist, Lauren Groff, graduate of the class of 2001, and author of the highly acclaimed first novel, The Monsters of Templeton, which appeared last spring at Hyperion Press, and soon after spent an impressive amount of time on the New York Times bestseller list. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, to get started, could you give our listeners an idea of what the novel is about?
Absolutely. Even though the title of the book is The Monsters of Templeton, it's very much about my hometown of Cooperstown, New York. And it's famous for having the Baseball Hall of Fame. But there are many other things in Cooperstown, even though most visitors probably wouldn't see them. We have a wonderful opera. We have spectacular natural beauty. We have a few other really wonderful museums, and we have James Fenimore Cooper, too, who's pretty much the most famous person ever from our town. He's the son of the founder of the town, William Cooper, who was an incredible land developer back in the day when upstate New York was the wilderness. And so we have a lot of things, and we have a lot of legends that small-town America tends to hold close to its chest. And it's a town of 2,000 people, so everyone knows everyone else, which is fantastic when you're my age and you go back and you know everyone walking down the street, but, you know, as a high school student, it's claustrophobic and a very small world. And so this book, I really wanted to write a book that I was feeling homesick at the time that I started it. I was living in California, and the world in the San Francisco Bay Area is very different from the world of Cooperstown, New York. And I wanted to live in Cooperstown for a few hours at least every day. So I was homesick, and I started to write about Cooperstown. And I did a lot of historical research, because what I wanted to do was write this novel that sort of spanned the entire life of Cooperstown so far. And after about four drafts, I fell into the story that I have now, which is the story of a young woman who is from the town and sort of the scion of the town's founders. And her life just falls apart. Her name's Willie Upton, and she comes home, and among many other things that happen, she finds out from her mother that her father was not the person or people that she thought that he was. Willie goes and she looks into her family history in order to figure out who her father eventually ends up being. And there's a monster in the lake that dies. But that's my big overriding metaphor for the book. And I can talk about that a little bit later if you want.
Well, regarding that that monster that dies in the beginning of the book, now, when one thinks of monsters in the tradition of literary monsters, one thinks of Grendel or Frankenstein or maybe even the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Now, where would you situate your monster in relation to that tradition?
Well, you know, I love all three of those books that you actually mentioned. Grendel, I have open all the time. John Gardner is a genius. But my monster has pretty much all the metaphorical weight in my book in a lot of ways. It's more a thematic monster than an actual character. I say this, and yet at the same time, that's the character I miss the most. And that's actually, a myth from when I was growing up. You know, when I was a little girl, we would scare each other silly at, you know, sleepovers and campfires about this mythical monster in Lake Otsego, which actually has its base in history. I mean, there have been sightings of a monster from the deeps. And for me, what happened was, when I was writing my fourth draft, I was reading Moby Dick, and I was also sort of in despair because I'd written three drafts. And I just thought, you know, I'm never going to finish this book. I'm done. I'm just going to, you know, have fun with it. And because Moby Dick was actually the monster, the whale that I modeled my monster on, but my monster ended up being kind of sweet and lovable in the very end. But, you know, it's something that, it's a secretive sort of thing, something that my characters don't really believe in and yet kind of see at times. And it's sort of the way that I feel about the monster in Lake Otsego. And I have a sighting story, too, about when I actually saw the monster. But
would you be willing to share some of that with us today?
Sure, if you want it. Okay. Well, what happened was, my sister is this incredible athlete, and when she was 14, she swam Lake Otsego, which is about 9.5 miles long. And she got the record for doing that. And I'm her older sister, and I thought, you know, and I was a big swimmer at the time too, and I thought, if my little sister can do this, I can totally do it. So I get up in the middle of the early morning at about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and my dad and I go down to the end of the lake, and he gets into a canoe, and we start swimming, and I start, and I'm off across the lake. And it's really dark out for the first probably 3 or 4 miles. And when the sun rises over Lake Otsego in the summer, it's just unbelievably beautiful. Everything lights up. There are billions of colors in the water, shadows, and there are currents, very strange, very deep currents in the water, too. And so I'm swimming along, and I haven't eaten anything for 5 miles, and I'm also incredibly nearsighted in person and don't have my contacts in or anything. And so I don't even know what the explanation is, but I'm swimming along, and I look down right when the light strikes the water, and I see this creature sort of swimming below me, and I think, wow, that's kind of amazing that it's keeping pace with me. And then I look further, and it seems really, really deep. And if it's really that deep, it's really, really big. So that's my sighting story. And what happened when I got out was actually, I wasn't scared. And that might have been the lack of oxygen to the brain or something, too. But I was very thrilled, and it filled me with a sense of mystery and beauty, and I held that in my heart, and I didn't really tell anybody about what I saw because I didn't know really if it was true or if I'd hallucinated. Plus, I didn't want people thinking I was completely insane. And I sort of carried that years later to the book, and that's sort of what the impression I wanted the reader to get at the end. The same sort of sense of mystery and awe and beauty. And by the way, my sister beat my time by 2 minutes.
Oh, there we go. There
I know.
We go.
Right. That's okay, though.
But look, to return to the book a little bit here,
sure.
the title of the book isn't The Monster of Templeton.
No.
It's The Monsters of Templeton, in the plural. So one has the impression that the monster in the lake is not the only one in town. So in what other ways does the metaphor of monstrosity inform the character of this town, Templeton, or some of the characters that inhabit it?
Well, to be honest, pretty much almost every character in the book is a little bit monstrous. And by that I mean, especially the historical characters have this veneer of respectability, but in effect they're actually, they have some pretty dark secrets. And so I guess I was exploring the theme of just internal grotesquery in a lot of ways, and it's still being empathetic toward my characters and sort of saying, you know, we do have this impression of the historical characters that we venerate, like George Washington, for instance. You know, they're these prim, proper, completely perfect people, and they're not. You know, they have these deep, dark secrets inside, too. So that was one of the things that I was trying to do with the whole monster idea.
Well, to follow that a little bit further, the romantic tradition, in the romantic tradition, the notion of monstrosity is oftentimes associated with the notion of poetic representation itself. And I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit on how that metaphor plays itself out in the form of your novel, or is there a relationship there?
You mean as in the structure of the book itself?
Yes, I was thinking along the lines of the diversity of voices that you include in the narrative, relative as analogous to the kind of hybrid monster that you've got inhabiting the lake.
That's absolutely sort of precisely the point of the structure of the book. Thank you for realizing this. The town itself is sort of a beautiful monster in its own way. And what I had intended to do with the structure of the book was to show the multiplicity of the town in the voices that rise up from its past and its present.
To take another step, one normally associates monstrosity with the notion of fear, the theme of fear, and I wonder if we could talk about fear for a little bit, since the theme of fear strikes me as being wholly appropriate in our own moment in history, and maybe this is something you had in mind, that it intersects with our own historical moment. You refer at one point to 9/11, which was an event that occurred only 4 months after you graduated from Amherst College, if I'm not mistaken. And there's a moment at which the narrator, Willie, who in many ways strikes me as a strong, determined woman, but at the same time seems rather fragile now and again, she seems to reflect the anxiety of a whole generation of young Americans, the current generation, and the kinds of feelings that they might be having right now, even in the midst of all of the financial crisis that America has been experiencing recently. And I thought I'd read you a little passage and then see if you'd be willing to share your thoughts about it. It's at a point where the narrator, Willie, is concerned about circumstances in the world. And she's speaking to a friend of hers named Peter. It goes, "Peter, I said, this is terrible. The world is falling apart faster than we can catch up. And the one place in the world where it's not supposed to fall apart seems to be rotting too. I come home to Templeton because it's the only place in the world that never changes. And I mean never, never changes. And here's this half-dead lake. I always thought, hey, if the ice caps melt and all the cities of the world are swallowed up, Templeton will be fine. We'd be able to make do, plant vegetables, bunker up, sit it out, whatever. But it doesn't seem right anymore, does it?" Could you share your thoughts about that passage?
That's pretty much directly the way that I think about Cooperstown. And, you know, you're right, I did graduate 4 months before 9/11. But it's sort of this feeling of oppression has been with me. And I would, you know, I can't speak for my entire generation, but I'd say probably with the rest of my generation forever. You know, it's not quite like the generation before that grew up with the atom bomb, you know, the fear of that, but we've had the fear of global warming and holes in the ozone, and it just does seem that things are getting scarier and scarier at a much faster rate. And in a way, that passage comes up against my romantic notions of my hometown, which is that it doesn't change. And sort of the whole point of the book is that, one of the points of the book is that everything changes, right? Even things that you think are static. And so, you know, I wanted very much to wrestle with that idea, because it shows up in pretty much everything that I write, this sort of oppressive fear of what could happen and what does happen.
Well, it seems to be obviously a major theme, and you have this backdrop of fear. But what's interesting to me is that Willie seems to tell the story in a fairly light, ironic tone, as though there's a certain bemused detachment from this background of fear, even though the fear is genuine. And I wondered if you saw the narrator's evolution in the book as a kind of apprenticeship during which she learns how to cope with fear. Is this a posture to adopt relative to contemporary events?
I think that's absolutely the posture that at least the people that I know and the writers that I know tend to seize almost instinctively. I think we're a very ironic generation. And it is a lightning. It's a way to to live in the fear and not let it overwhelm you. And so I do think that her attitude is partially posturing, absolutely. And the other part is that she's telling it in retrospect, too. So that from the point where she's telling the story, she's already gone through all of the events that have happened, so she has a little bit of distance on the events. But absolutely, you're right. I think it's a generational irony. And I never actually thought of that before this question, so thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. But now to go back to kind of reaction to the change that there is and the environment of fear. Throughout most of the novel, Willie is, the narrator, is consumed by this desire to uncover the truth of her own personal origins that you mentioned when you described the plot. She's looking for her real father. And despite her mother's wishes, she wants to try to find out the identity of this fellow. So there's a moment where she has a realization about that desire to find one's personal origins. And I wanted to share it with our listeners and then hear what comments you might have about the passage. I found it to be a passage that was really quite insightful. Here it is. The narrator's talking about this search for the identity of her father and says, "And yet we cling to these things. We pretend to be able to understand. We need the idea of the first humanoid in North America, though we will never find him. We need a mass of ancestors at our backs as ballast. Sometimes we feel it's impossible to push into the future without such a weight behind us, without such heaviness to keep us steady, even if it is imaginary. And the more frightening the future is, the more complicated it seems to be, the more we steady ourselves with the past. I looked at my father and felt an impossible relief. It didn't matter, not really, that I had him at last. It didn't matter, and yet in my illogical, unfathomable heart, it did. I was glad to have his real, breathing self on that long road behind me. I was glad to know he was there." So, if you could comment on this dual nature of the desire to find a specific identity of a father, this desire, despite the recognition that there's a certain imaginary component to it.
Sure. Well, I think the passage, and you read that beautifully, by the way. I think the passage is the way that I feel we all attack our futures. I mean, we need to know where we come from in order to know how to steer toward the future and to have. And the imaginary construct of our past, even though we can't necessarily know what has happened before our own existence, to have a construct sort of in our hearts and in our minds of our ancestors and where we come from, I think that's really important because it acts as ballast. It's a way to steady ourselves and to be able to face the future and face the fear that we were talking about earlier. So when Willie does find her father, and you know, she will never really know him the way that she probably wants to, because he comes into her life when she's almost 30, 28. You know, just to have the idea of him there, it's a steadying idea. To have the idea of a Templeton that she knows much better than she did at the beginning of the summer is a steadying idea. And even if what she had learned is actually more false than true, it still makes her become a more solid and more forward-looking person, sort of paradoxically in a way.
Well, she seems to cling to this need to know the precise identity of her one biological father, but she did have other father figures in the novel, and of course I'm thinking of the kind of collective father figure one sees in the character of the Running Buds, which is a jogging club. I'm very fond of these guys, consisting of very sympathetic middle-aged men who jog through the narrative together at comically appropriate times, like a lump of undifferentiated masculinity rolling through town. And they treat her like a daughter. Why is that not sufficient for Willie? Why does she need to know the one biological father?
Well, first of all, about the Running Buds, they are based on my dad's group of running friends. And, you know, the individuals are completely different, but the collective is sort of adorable and loving and wonderful. But, you know, Willie needed to know who her individual father was because all of her life she hadn't thought that she had one. And then suddenly when her mom suggests that there is an individual father and you might actually know who he is and you can figure it out, then just for a person of her imagination, she needs to know. And she needs to know because of what we were talking about earlier, this ballast, but also because it's a way for her to know who she is in this time when she's lost all conception of who she is. And it's sort of to see him in her as opposed to just seeing her mother in her. And her mother is this kooky, kind of wild character who changes now to sort of pulling the rug out of Willie in that direction too. So Willie's desire to know exactly who her father was, I'm not sure I've ever thought of it before why she needed to, but it just seemed logical that she would, the personality that she has, she would do everything in her might to find out. Plus, you know, it drives the story forward.
Well, now the question of who Willie is an interesting one, particularly with this kind of gray area between fiction and autobiography that we have in this book. And I noticed that at one point towards the end of the book, you have what is said to be a photograph of Willie in a graduation gown that is taken from behind her, and I don't want to reveal any secrets about the book necessarily, but it looks a whole lot like you did at your own Amherst graduation. And it made me think that at another point in the story, there's a character that exclaims, amazing thing, fiction tells you more sometimes about the writer than the writer can tell you about himself in any memoir. So along those lines, and since we're here in the series Amherst Reads, the circumstances dictate that I ask you the following. How did your experience at Amherst inform your novel, and what role did Amherst play in any, if at all, in your becoming a writer?
Well, first of all, about the autobiographical element, and, you know, that's something that I get asked all the time, but it's pretty minor. you know, I have a father that I know very well, and I'm not, you know, my family's not from Cooperstown. I'm not Willie, thank God, because she is really annoying in some ways, but I sort of admire her in other ways, too. But about Amherst, you know, Amherst was the biggest single changing event in my life as an adult. And the reason why is because it taught me how to think, and it taught me how to approach the world with a variety of perspectives, which, you know, I came from a very small town, and I wasn't given that ability before I went to Amherst. So, you know, and being a literature major is in French and English is to be someone who studies the ways into other people's hearts. And so, you know, Amherst is essentially the opposite of a vocational school for me in a lot of ways. I didn't really learn how to do anything, but I did learn how to think and how to have empathy, and how to approach the world with sort of an open heart. And you don't think of a liberal arts education as sort of an expansion of not just a brain, but for me, it was an expansion of a heart too. So those are the things. And for Amherst in the book, Amherst does appear in the book and a couple of times. Willie goes there, like me. And I guess the other thing too was I was playing around very deeply with. Sort of joyously, too, with the concept of my own autobiography in the book. I sort of wanted people to ask that question sort of mischievously, even though I don't really have much personal experience in Willie's experience. And that is absolutely a picture of me. That's primarily because nobody I knew would give me a picture of him that I could use as Willie as an adult. But also... at Amherst, my senior thesis was an English thesis with Professor Parker on autobiography in fiction. And what I did was I read a lot of criticism of autobiography and a lot of autobiography, a lot of them, autobiographies themselves, and sort of attacked the ideas that I gleaned through writing. It was a creative thesis, but sort of a critical one at the same time too. And so in fun, not very smart, but it was fun. And yeah, I go back and I like reading it because it makes me laugh. Because it's a really good idea of who I was at 22.
Well, to follow that a little bit further,
sure.
There's clearly an interesting interplay here in the thematics of your work between fiction and history and fiction and autobiography. And you seem to suggest that there's no real clear distinction between these literary categories. Is that the case?
I absolutely believe that's the case. I believe an autobiography is only that if its author calls it that. Because it's what memoirs and nonfiction books are individually framed narratives that come from a single person, and that's what fiction is also. And so, there's a gray line, and I think that gray line is incredibly exciting and very thrilling to play around with, and I probably will continue to play around with it, even though, because it is, it's naughty. People don't really like having their expectations thrown up in their faces. So,
well, I can't tell you how delighted I am to hear that there's not too close a connection between your own autobiography and the novel, since I noticed that, and I almost hesitate to point this out, that one of the most unequivocally evil characters in your book is a professor of French. I wondered if you'd care to comment on that.
Well, yeah, all of my French professors were absolutely spectacular, and they're not modeled on any single human being that I know. I think you're talking about Lacroix.
Monsieur Lacroix,
yes.
The one who is on page 170, quote, ugly old French teacher, unquote.
Well, I had to write against what I knew, and every French teacher I know is gorgeous and young and intelligent. So, he was just a name that I picked up from a James Fenimore Cooper character, actual character.
I see.
And then it sort of expanded in my head to become what he ends up being in the book, who is, probably not evil, but the way that he's presented through the letters that he's presented in is, he becomes an evil character. But he's probably, who knows? If I were to write a story from his point of view, it'd probably be very empathetic, and he'd be a kind, sweet person. But it's not in his point of view. So, no, French professors are fabulous.
That's always a good thing to wrap up an interview with, a sense of reassurance. So maybe we'll have to stop there. But Lauren Groff, author of the critically acclaimed first novel, The Monsters of Templeton, which I highly recommend to our readers. To our listeners. It's a wonderful read. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.